From Hawaii to South Carolina, Tennessee to Oregon, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, Russia presents the Biden administration with a major foreign policy challenge that could be the president's Achilles heel. Keith Naughton from Silent Majority Strategies is here to discuss. Under the guise of voting rights, President Biden and congressional Democrats are seeking to rig the playing field for future elections. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Senator Elizabeth Warren is blaming grocery stores for runaway inflation, but her own policies are actually at fault. Eric Boehm and Joe Lancaster of Reason Magazine report. And on this week's American Radio Journal commentary, Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA explains why the so-called For the People Act, which would fundamentally change how elections are held, is deeply flawed. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Russia has massed troops on their border with the Ukraine, and the Biden administration is trying to prevent an invasion. But Keith Naughton of Silent Majority Strategies says their policy of appeasement, rather than using a mix of economic sanctions and military might, will not work. He joins us now to discuss. Keith, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Keith, your article that you wrote for The Hill, you're talking about all the problems that Joe Biden and his administration have, which are many, and you are arguing that relations with Russia and how the president is dealing with President Putin could be his big Achilles heel. Why do you think that?
Well, I think because his administration has been very weak on foreign policy. They talk a good game, but they seem to really shrink from confrontation. And that is the kind of thing that just encourages aggressive opponents of this country, whether we invite them to be or not, to be more aggressive. And one thing that we found is that while Americans don't really care very much about foreign policy on a day-to-day basis, they are concerned about security. And if they start to perceive that the country is at a security risk, whether it's internationally or whether it's rising crime within the country domestically, they start to turn against the current administration. And I think it's a serious problem because both Biden, and this is a hangover from the Obama foreign policy, they have no understanding of the concept of deterrence. They think that making concessions is the way to make deals with people like Putin, and that is certainly not the case.
Putin, of course, is doing a lot of saber rattling, looking at the countries around him, particularly Ukraine, as potential acquisitions. Tell us a little bit about the Biden administration's approach to this potential conflict, and is it really something that's going to be effective against somebody like Vladimir Putin?
Well, I think it's a real problem because they've only used rhetoric. And then they've threatened like really, really tough sanctions. Well, sanctions hasn't really contained Russia very well in the past. Or at the very least, they've managed to find ways to armor themselves against American sanctions. So I think it's really not much of a threat. And what I called my piece, probably the dumbest geopolitical move in the last 70 years, they approved this Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which I think some of your listeners know. You know, Russia's a huge gas exporter. Right now, they have to send their exports through Poland or through the Ukraine, and those countries are able to cut those exports off and really eliminate a lot of jobs and foreign currency for Russia. The Russians have built this pipeline through the Baltic Sea that connects directly to Germany, bypassing those countries. The Trump administration had a huge sanctions regime and had that pipeline stopped. And the Biden administration dropped those sanctions for no concessions, for nothing in return. So they've compromised the security of Poland and the Ukraine for nothing. And that's really why we find ourselves in this situation.
Relative to the economy in Russia, Keith, are economic problems part of what is driving Putin's expansionist efforts here?
Well, he's got two issues, and it's economic in the more short term, and but demographic in the long term. Economics, or wages are stagnant in Russia. It doesn't have a growing economy. Now, he has built up a lot of foreign reserves, so he's kind of resistant to the short-term sanctions. Russia's biggest problem is the demography. I mean, they're having a shrinking population. They have very high mortality from poor health, and they're about to experience a complete collapse in births to the point that they could be losing population at 1 million people a year by 2026 or 2027. Russia has fewer women aged 20 to 24 than they have women aged 70 to 74, which is just an incredible statistic. You haven't seen anything like that in the world. I think Russia and Putin sees this crisis coming, and he's got to take advantage of a very short window to expand the country, to try to remedy it, to try to push back against the United States and NATO. And that's really what this whole situation comes down to. It's his long-term weakness that is pushing him to act.
Back in the 1980s, Ronald Reagan, of course, Keith, was very, very tough on the then Soviet Union. And he utilized economic pressures basically to cause the dissolution of the Soviet Union. So is this a tool that is available now to the Biden administration if they were tough enough to actually use it?
Well, Reagan used a combination of economic pressure and military pressure. There was a large American military buildup, and the Soviets knew that Reagan was down for business. You know, Reagan actually pushed back the boundaries of Soviet influence, sometimes using military force in places like Grenada and spots in Africa and Latin America and so forth. Just using economic sanctions would not have worked for Reagan, and it doesn't work now, because it doesn't offer deterrence. I mean, I don't think Putin believes that Biden is going to resort to a military force or resort to, you know, make significant aid for Ukraine. Biden hasn't really pushed back against Russian expansionism. So he's got a big enough bank account that he can survive economic sanctions. Biden needs to establish credible American military deterrence. And America is a credible threat in combination with economic sanctions for it to work.
Given all the weaknesses that you've just described that Putin has in Russia, is this a case where Biden and his weak approach, and the fact the Obama-Biden administration that preceded Trump also had a weak approach to Russia, ironically because Donald Trump got accused of being a Russian pawn, but is this a case of where Biden's weakness is what's really driving the ability of Putin to remain this major player?
I think it absolutely encourages Putin's aggression. I mean, if you think we can push against this door to expand influence and to help prop up the country, he's going to do it.
We have been talking with Keith Naughton. Keith is the principal of Silent Majority Strategies, frequently is a columnist in The Hill. He has written an article entitled, Will Putin Sink Biden? And you can read that, what, at thehill.com, Keith?
Yes.
And where can they go to learn more about Silent Majority Strategies?
SilentMajorityStrategies.com.
SilentMajorityStrategies.com. Keith Naughton. Keith, thank you for being back with us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. He's keeping an eye on a move by Democrats led by President Biden to try and change the manner in which we conduct elections in this country. Scott, first of all, good to have you here. And what are the Democrats trying to achieve this Martin Luther King Day weekend?
The bottom line is that the Senate Democrats, led by Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, are trying to change election laws forever, so that the states no longer control their elections, but that the federal government, and especially the Democrats in charge right now, can basically rig elections in the future and create these new laws that will constrict real voting rights and protecting the integrity of the ballot in exchange for reforms that ultimately can allow for Democrats to conceal the way that votes are cast and decrease transparency in voting. There's a lot of Americans out there in the states that strongly support voter ID in order to cast a vote. And the Democrats want to get rid of voter ID laws. They want to make that unconstitutional. Obviously, the Constitution says the states should be able to maintain and set their own election laws. But Democrats want to come in and basically say, no, you can't restrict the number of days for early voting. You can't change voter ID laws unless the Department of Justice has this strong oversight capability. We've seen Joe Biden this week down in Georgia, and he's been calling election reforms like the state of Georgia's election reforms, Jim Crow 2.0. That's obviously inappropriate rhetoric compared to what exactly Jim Crow laws were several generations ago in the 1950s, especially. So we know that Republicans want to preserve that idea of one person, one ballot, one vote, but Democrats obviously want to have the ability to harvest votes like they've done forever in California. They want to be able to have same-day registration, which creates all sorts of complications and potentials for additional voter fraud. And I think that that's a dangerous concern, especially as at least 45-50% of the country think that there was tomfoolery, is what I'll call it, in the 2020 election.
One of the ways they want to achieve this, Scott, is to do away with the Senate filibuster. And the filibuster invoking cloture requires getting 60 votes rather than 50. The movement is afoot to do that. Is that something that could potentially be successful in this case?
Well, we get into the weeds here with Senate procedure and precedent. And the precedent is that it typically takes a two-thirds vote to be able to change the rules of the Senate. However, to change precedent in the Senate, it can take a simple majority. So when the Senate Democrats back in 2013 underneath Harry Reid did the nuclear option on most judicial nominations, they changed the precedent of the Senate to allow for nominations to be confirmed at 51 votes. But when you look at the actual Senate rules, that rule has never been changed. Mitch McConnell did the same thing for Supreme Court nominations. So they do this by appealing the ruling of the chair, which is the presiding officer of the Senate, in how the rules are adjudicated. So when a rule is broken, the chair would raise a point of order, and then another senator can appeal the ruling of the chair, and that's how you change the precedent. So that's what Chuck Schumer wants to do when it comes to the legislative filibuster. The good news for the preservation of our constitutional republic is that there's a couple of Democrats that are with all the Republicans right now in opposing those filibuster reforms. And once again, we bring back our focus to Senator Joe Manchin from West Virginia and Senator Kyrsten Sinema from Arizona. So this isn't just two senators that's blocking exactly what Chuck Schumer wants to do. This is 52. There are a majority of senators that want to prevent any changes to the legislative filibuster and preserve the Senate norms that it requires cloture, meaning 60 votes, a three-fifths majority, in order to end debate and then move to final passage on legislation.
We will, of course, continue to follow that. Let's switch gears a little bit here and talk economics in the last minute or two we have, Scott. And inflation, the genie's out of the bottle. It's running out of control. What was the inflation rate for 2021?
We learned this week that in December we had 7% inflation in America. Consumers are paying higher costs at the pump. We're paying more for poultry and beef. We're paying more for lumber, construction costs. Everything across the board costs more now. And when folks in December were looking at, oh, did I get a raise? Did I get a bonus? How exactly am I making things work with my own income? A lot of people got raises that were less than 7%, I'm willing to bet, in America. So we're actually having a lower earning power and income potential than we would have had a year earlier. So that's exactly what the Biden stimulus spending and overall approach to increasing coronavirus pandemic relief and these infrastructure bills, they're pumping so much money into the economy that we're obviously seeing increased prices, and that ends up being a hidden tax increase on the American people. And so I think as folks really understand the economic consequences of exactly what unified government underneath Joe Biden with Democrats controlling the House and Senate means that's going to be a top-level issue in the 2022 elections, and I would certainly expect Republicans to fight with all their might against additional hidden tax increases, blatant tax increases, additional spending that's going to cause even more inflation. And then what we should also be watching is what the Fed Reserve here does in the coming months and whether or not they want to jack up interest rates.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, tell our folks listening a little bit more about the club.
Yeah, the Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. We're united in economic freedom, liberty, and opportunity. Check us out on our website, clubforgrowth.org. You can join 250,000 other members for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you again for being here.
Thank you.
As mentioned by Scott, inflation soared in 2021 to levels not seen since the 1970s. And now the left is seeking to deflect blame from its own failed economic policies. Eric Boehm and Joe Lancaster of Reason Magazine are here to explain.
Grocery stores pretty famously are not the type of businesses that run huge profit margins. There's a lot of competition between stores. Shoppers are generally very conscious of prices. So it's a little bit weird, and some might even say completely wrong, for someone like Senator Elizabeth Warren to be out there claiming that grocery stores are price gouging people, raising prices, and that that's the cause of inflation right now. But alas, that is something that the senator from Massachusetts has recently claimed, and we're going to take a closer look at that today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Joe Lancaster. He is a colleague of mine at Reason, and he's recently written about this idea that Warren has floated, this idea of using antitrust to break up big grocery chains or something as a way to combat inflation. Joe joins us on the phone now from Georgia to talk about this and to debunk some of what Elizabeth Warren has been pushing. Joe, thanks for taking some time with us today.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, thanks.
Let's just get right to it. This was about a week ago now. Senator Elizabeth Warren was on MSNBC, and she just like went after Kroger for no good reason.
Yeah, she singled out Kroger specifically. They're talking about, you know, the general prices going up around the country that we've all seen a little bit, and she started talking about grocery stores, singling out Kroger, and saying that basically when a handful of the giant grocery chains dominate an industry, that they are able to rake in record profits, price gouge, drive up their own profits at the expense of workers. And yeah, like you say, there's really not a worse industry that she could have used as an example. NYU data from this month shows that the average profit margin in the entire retail grocery industry is about 1.1%. Kroger specifically, in their most recent quarter, which ended in November, I believe, their profit margin was 0.75%. So, I mean, for every $100 that goes into their cash registers, Kroger is clearing, after expenses, about 75 cents.
This seems to be a thing that Warren has been on about for a little while now. I remember back around Thanksgiving, there were several tweets that she sent out about corporations are price gouging you, and that's why your Thanksgiving turkey costs more this year. I mean, she seems to be really the leader of this idea on the left that, oh, inflation isn't the result of, it's not the entirely predictable result of the government dumping a ton of money into the economy over the last couple of years. It is instead weirdly the result of like corporate greed that I guess didn't exist at the, like, corporate greed suddenly got a lot higher in the last few months than it did before. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me, but that's basically it's a scapegoat tactic here.
Definitely. Yeah. And that, like you say, it's a thing that companies have apparently only just recently discovered, that they could jack up their prices and people would still apparently buy the same things from the same places without adjusting their spending patterns at all, as if all the grocery stores colluded together at this moment, and which is a thing that she actually did in the same appearance make that case, that they all of the people who run the grocery store chains looked at inflation and the skewed supply chain and decided this is our chance.
they decided to collude together and make 1% profits instead of colluding together to make, I don't know, 5 or 10% profits. We're talking with Joe Lancaster. He is an associate editor at Reason Magazine. He's a colleague of mine at Reason. And we're talking about Elizabeth Warren trying to scapegoat inflation on corporations, including grocery stores. Joe, before I let you go, I want to touch on this other idea that she's floated, which is like somehow using antitrust legislation to break up big grocery chains. And I heard that. And I thought, I live in a, you know, not a, a big, you know, moderately sized town, pretty far outside of the suburbs of D.C. And yet, even here, I've got a Safeway, a Weiss. I don't have a Kroger, but I've got a Lidl, which is like a German grocery store chain that's now coming into the U.S. I have literally like 5 or 6 grocery stores that I could drive to within 15 minutes, 10 to 15 minutes of my house. The idea that this is like some sort of monopoly just kind of boggles the mind, doesn't it?
Yeah, and she wrote a letter a month or two ago to the heads of the three of the biggest chains, which was Kroger, Albertsons, and Publix, making that claim, the type of monopoly claim, which, I mean, if there are three of them, then it's not a monopoly. But even so, I mean, those three, I live in Georgia. We're Kroger country. I live in a town of about 100,000 people. We have 4 or 5 Krogers, not to mention Publix, not to mention Ingles, Piggly Wiggly, and smaller chains as well. And plus, you can go to, you know, we have a Walmart market too. So yeah, there are options. And that's kind of what lends the grocery industry to be not really where you would look to for massive profit margins, which is, I mean, Apple can more or less set its own price for an iPhone. They're the only ones who make it. It's popular. If you want it, you got to go to them. If you're buying Lean Cuisine or Frosted Flakes, it's the same anywhere. There's no real room for that profit, whether it's from Kroger, whether it's from Albertsons, or whether it's from the 7-Eleven.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I mean, you made the point there that like if you're writing a letter claiming you're a monopoly and you're sending that letter to three different companies, like it kind of defeats the point that you're making. That and I think I think a terrific point that there's not just is there a lot of competition in this marketplace, but there's actually more competition in this marketplace now. You can get groceries delivered from Walmart. You can get groceries delivered by Amazon. They're always building more grocery stores. So Elizabeth Warren just completely off base. She's living in a fantasy world here, and I assume this is all just a political attempt to deflect away from the actual obvious cause of this inflation that we're seeing, which is all of the money that was dumped into the economy over the past year, particularly that big stimulus bill in the spring. But we're out of time for today. Joe, thanks for taking some time with us.
Absolutely. Thank you, Eric.
And again, that's Joe Lancaster. He's an associate editor at Reason Magazine, his colleague of mine over there. You can check out his latest piece at Reason.com. Elizabeth Warren blames high food prices on grocery chains' record 1% profit margins. Find that again at Reason.com. I'm Eric Boehm. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Congressional efforts to take control of elections from the states would undermine the nation's faith in the electoral process. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA explains why on this American Radio Journal commentary.
In the short history of the Biden presidency, last Tuesday will go down as a major turning point, downward. For numbers freaks, you can remember the date as 11122, January 11th, 2022. That's when Joe Biden gave in to his handlers, speechwriters, and political consultants and decided to embrace brazen demagoguery in his Atlanta speech on so-called voting rights. The man who less than 1 year earlier had promised that his presidency would be one of healing and coming together called anyone who opposed him racists, seditionists, and traitors. I am convinced that the speech will backfire badly and not only lose him the prospect of compromise, but also trigger defections from his own ranks from those who can clearly see what the poor president cannot, that his descent into demagoguery will be toxic and win him no transformative legislation in Congress. In short, it's the day that he abandoned the positive rhetoric of his inaugural speech and embraced a type of speech that, in the words of Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, was incoherent, incorrect, beneath his office, and profoundly unpresidential. The ostensible subject of his speech was the stalled federalization of our national voting system. As proposed legislation, it is flawed and objectionable. But the speech had little to do with the bill's actual policy content. Unfortunately, neither did most of the subsequent speeches and opinion pieces from Republican senators or conservative constitutional policy shops and think tanks. Most of them fell into the trap of responding to Biden's demagoguery with only slightly toned-down demagoguery of their own, or unpersuasive, wonky defense of arcane Senate rules. The Biden of 36 years in the Senate, 8 years in the vice presidency, a year of presidential campaigning, and a well-received inaugural speech less than a year ago, relinquished his principles in Atlanta on Tuesday, just shy of 1 year in office. He lost the moderate center of American politics, without which he cannot lead. He could have attempted to maximize the value of his time in the bully pulpit of the presidency to persuade the American people why they should support the stalled legislation. Had he mentioned specifics, rather than vilifying his opponents and disparaging the Senate filibuster that he long supported as Jim Crow 2.0, he might have made some converts. Ronald Reagan used televised presidential speeches as opportunities to speak directly to the American people and to persuade them of the common sense of his proposed policies or actions. Biden saw Reagan exploit the opportunities and achieve legislative success with a smaller base of congressional support. Biden wasted this opportunity. So did many of the Republicans and a wide swath of opinion writers responding to the president. They decried Biden's hateful demagoguery but said little about the actual proposals. There is plenty that's wrong in the bill that Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer has pledged to put on the Senate floor on Martin Luther King Day. It gives virtual veto power to potentially partisan bureaucrats in the Justice Department to overrule states who pass voting reforms that they don't like. It restricts states from cleaning up their voter rolls by purging records of those who have died or moved. It mandates same-day voter registration, which is a wide-open door to facilitating voting by non-citizens. It also mandates automatic voter registration via the driver's license registration process at state motor vehicle offices, opening the door to register as voters huge numbers of legal drivers who are not legal citizens. It would force states to redistrict along standards that would favor urban areas, thereby giving an enduring advantage to Democrats in drawing congressional districts. Republicans, conservatives, and constitutionalists should focus on these objectionable elements of the proposed voting revision bills rather than making obscure procedural arguments in support of the filibuster and ceding the policy ground to Democrats. A total reset may still happen if President Biden's bumbling political miscalculation in adopting anger and demagoguery over reasoned persuasion last Tuesday has the effect of killing the proposed bills. That would wipe the slate clean for another pass, one that should be crafted in the spirit of bipartisanship, and that would be a good thing for the country. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WWOW-AM in Conneaut, Ohio, WTIM-AM in Somerville, Massachusetts, along with WXMC-AM in Troy Hills, New Jersey. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.